Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dory Smith. Ken Silverstein, Washington editor for Harper's Magazine, joins us to talk about Senator John McCain's growing credibility problem and his latest Harper's piece titled "McCain Cronies Hit Jackpot with G-Tech." According to the story appearing in the October issue of Harper's, G-Tech and another firm called Scientific Games dominate the lottery and online gaming industry. McCain wrote or helped write major legislation involving Native American tribes seeking to open casinos. He also served as chairman of the Indian Affairs Committee twice. Ken Silverstein is author of a recently released book, Turkmenistan: How Washington Lobbyists Fought to Flak for a Stalinist Dictatorship. Recent exposés about Senator McCain's gambling habits have been overshadowed by news of the $700 billion bailout of Wall Street and the banking industry, but revelations about the extent of McCain's involvement with gambling industry lobbyists could be a kind of last straw for conservative voters who were already worried about a growing list of contradictions between what McCain says and what he does, either as Arizona's senator or in his private life. Evangelicals who have supported McCain more recently due to his selection of Alaska Governor Sarah Palin as a running mate could also start to back away from their support for the Republican over gambling. Shortly after McCain's selection of Palin, she made headlines for her stand on abortion and her spiritual roots in several Pentecostal churches in Alaska. The Anchorage Daily News published an interview with Sarah Palin conducted by the Eagle Forum during her 2006 run for governor. Palin was asked, quote, "Do you support the expansion of gambling in Alaska?" She answered, quote, "No. In so many cases, gambling has shown ill effects on families. And as governor, I would not propose expansion legislation." Palin added that she would not sign any bills expanding gaming in Alaska. The Democratic National Committee has released an ad about McCain's ties to the gambling industry.
Well, I am a betting man.
The ad lists some of John McCain's political ties with some 40 individuals in the gambling industry, showing pictures of McCain at casinos gambling, and describing how casino lobbyists organized the trips to casinos at the same time McCain was receiving hundreds of thousands of dollars from the industry for his campaigns. The New York Times has reported that one of those trips was to Foxwoods Casino in Connecticut, where the candidate played high-stakes poker and walked away a winner. Ken Silverstein, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you.
Just give us the basic details of this story about G-Tech and the other companies that you discovered McCain had ties with.
McCain obviously has been running as the maverick and the crusader against special interest groups and saying that, of course, he's going to crack down on lobbyists. And all along, it's been a little bit difficult to reconcile with the fact that so many top Washington lobbyists are running his campaign. I just looked at his relationship sort of at a micro level, his relationship with one firm called G-Tech, which is one of the biggest gambling firms in the country, dominates along with one other firm called Scientific Games, state lotteries, also very big in online gaming. And what's curious about it is that McCain cronies, lobbyists who have been very close to McCain and a number of them who are now running his campaign, are the only people who G-Tech ever seems to retain to do its lobbying. You know, it's like McCain cronies sort of have a lock on lobbying for this company. And it's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. In fact, I still need to tote up the total. It could be close to $1 million in total fees for the assorted lobbyists. So going back to 2001, actually going back as far as 1999, the firm G-Tech hired Charlie Black, who is a senior McCain advisor, and who not too long ago actually resigned from his lobbying firm when it was revealed by the Washington Post that he'd actually been working for clients at the back of the McCain bus, and that became a little embarrassing for Black, that he'd stop lobbying. This is one of the guys who worked for G-Tech. Another is campaign manager Rick Davis, who claims, although it's a little unclear, but he claims that he no longer has any relationship with Davis Manafort, one of the top lobbying firms in the city, and he worked for G-Tech between 1999 and 2001. The man who recommended Rick Davis for the job of campaign manager back in 2000 when he ran McCain's first campaign is another big GOP operative and lobbyist named Scott Reed. his firm called Chesapeake Enterprises was paid more than $100,000. And there are several others, including Doug Davenport, who used to be a McCain regional campaign manager until he quit earlier this year when it was revealed that his firm, called DCI, had worked for the Burmese military junta. So it's just striking. I mean, you go down the list of GTEC lobbyists, and it's a pretty good list of names. Every single one of them is at a firm that has pretty close ties to McCain. So it's curious, to say the least.
You mentioned Rick Davis, John McCain's campaign manager, and of course, the scandal was just starting to break about him that, you know, he had worked for Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae as a lobbyist, receiving $30,000 a month initially through 2002. And then John McCain told the Times, you know, please look at the record. He hasn't worked for them recently. But then the Times, looking into the record, finding, in fact, that a company co-owned by Rick Davis was earning $15,000 a month from Freddie Mac, you know, right through August of this year.
Well, it certainly appears that way. I mean, that's what Newsweek has reported. It's hard to know, actually, exactly what's going on because the lobby disclosure laws are so open-ended that it's very difficult to know who's lobbying for who. I mean, we get a partial picture, but there are lots of exceptions to the rules. Like, if you're doing public relations work and not directly going to Capitol Hill and talking to members of Congress or their offices, you don't have to report it. And it appears that Davis claimed that he was working for a Freddie Mac group called the Homeowners Alliance that Freddie Mac created, and that initially they were paying his firm, and, you know, and it apparently wasn't direct lobbying, so it hadn't been reported. Then he claimed that, you know, this wasn't really a problem because the money was going to his firm, and he had separated himself from the firm. He no longer had a relationship, and now, I haven't reported this myself, but Newsweek has a story out saying that Rick Davis actually never separated himself from his lobbying firm and that he still had a relationship. I think they discovered some corporate papers that had been filed in Virginia where Davis was still listed as an official with the firm. But, you know, Davis is one of the biggest lobbyists in Washington, and he's been a walking conflict of interest. It's not just GTEC and Freddie, but he used to work for a number of very, very big telecommunications firms between McCain's campaign runs. And, you know, McCain, at the time that Davis was representing some of these big clients, was on the Senate Commerce Committee, which was supposed to be overseeing and monitoring and regulating the telecom industry. So Davis has been a constant problem from a PR point of view because he appears to be a walking conflict of interest in terms of his clients and the McCain campaign.
Let's listen to CBS News anchor Katie Couric asking Governor Sarah Palin about Rick Davis and the payments from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
My understanding is Rick Davis recused himself from the dealings in that firm, I don't know how long ago, a year or two ago, and that he's not benefiting from that. And, you know, I would hope that that's the case.
But he still has a stake in the company, so isn't that a conflict of interest?
Again, my understanding is that he recused himself from the dealings with Freddie and Fannie, any lobbying efforts on his part there, and I would hope that that's the case, because as John McCain has been saying, and as I've been in on a much more local level, been also rallying against, is the undue influence of lobbyists in public policy decisions being made.
Ken Silverstein, why do you think it is that the McCain campaign staff, John McCain himself, and Sarah Palin too, seem to believe they can walk in this very dangerous territory unscathed of essentially saying one thing while doing another?
I think it's in part because, you know, these are McCain's closest associates, and, you know, he's got longstanding relationships with people like Charlie Black and Rick Davis. I mean, these have been his closest advisors and political allies for a long time, and maybe the McCain camp itself, or, I mean, Davis is the campaign manager, but maybe there were other officials at the campaign who weren't aware exactly of how big of a problem this was going to turn out to be. But I think it's difficult for McCain to distance himself from these people because they are his closest allies, friends, cronies, and political advisors. I would have to point out here, too, that Obama also, although he's been running the same sort of anti-establishment crusade and, you know, also very critical of lobbyists and promising to crack down on lobbyists, I don't think the ties are extensive, but, you know, he's hardly an innocent when it comes to relationships with lobbyists and, you know, lobbyists and lawyers who work for lobbying firms. That's a distinction that the Obama campaign likes to make. But they've raised a lot of money for his campaign. And, you know, some of the people around him certainly have worked as lobbyists. So, you know, look, this is Washington. The way our political system works is that, you know, it's fueled by money. Lobbyists raise a lot of money. Politicians are dependent, in part, on lobbyists to raise that money. And so, you know, everyone, when they're running for office, finds it very convenient to rail against the power of lobbyists. But in practice, nobody really wants to do a whole lot about it because these are the men and women who are playing a large role in drumming up the financial support they need to run for office. So it's an inherent conflict, and I think the McCain campaign maybe didn't foresee how big of a problem it was going to be, but it should have been pretty obvious because, you know, time and time again, you look at the senior people in the campaign, they've got long track records as lobbyists. So, you know, this is something that I think was bound to be a problem, and I expect we'll be hearing more stories between now and the election in November.
When McCain and Palin were campaigning in Ohio recently, John McCain referred to CEOs responsible for the recent mortgage lending crisis and failures as evil. And there is this good versus evil sort of flavor now to language they're using about Russia or even the Middle East. Why do you think they feel that they can push that sort of good Christian image, you know, when the other McCain, so to speak, is easily found in history? I mean, the angry man who has frequent fights on the floor of Congress, the guy who likes to gamble, as you're pointing out, the New York Times documenting that he would come and gamble, you know, play poker heavily at Foxwoods Casino, even while he was serving on the Indian Gaming Committee, the hardline politician who uses this very hawkish rhetoric about attacking Iran. It's just such a strange split for people to try to understand and accept.
Politicians being hypocritical is fairly routine in a way, and I think just in fairness, not to make a moral equivalence here, but this is fairly standard operating procedure among campaigns, and candidates tend to say a lot of things that behind the scenes doesn't quite mesh with their practices. I do think that in the case of McCain and gambling, you know, what's clearly a problem here is that the Christian conservative base of the campaign, of the Republican Party, doesn't like gambling. And it's embarrassing for, you know, and that's what I think is the problem, or, you know, the appearance problem, at least with McCain playing poker. I mean, there are a couple of things. One is that it's an industry that he's had some influence over. But to me, the bigger problem is just that this is sort of a standard problem in the Republican Party, is that you've got a Christian conservative base of the party that, you know, will come out to vote. And so, the party leadership is constantly kowtowing to the Christian base, when you know, in fact, that a lot of these guys just don't live a lifestyle that's entirely compatible with what the base of the party would be comfortable with. You know, and so in the case of McCain and gambling, I'm sure he's not wild to advertise that, because it just, you know, it's one more issue. I mean, he was never the first choice of the base. There were a number of issues that you know, he had to sort of swallow everything he said in 2000 about Jerry Falwell and the political figures like that, and basically curry favor with that wing of the party in the hopes of winning the nomination. And now he desperately needs that wing of the party to come out and vote for him if he has any chance of winning the election. So you've just got this inherent conflict. I mean, McCain truly, he's not a Christian conservative. I mean, he apparently doesn't go to church very often, but this is a role that anyone seeking high office in the Republican Party, and certainly the presidential candidate, has to, for appearance's sake, try to win that sector of the party. And so, you know, there's certainly a hypocritical element here when McCain is off gambling. But, you know, you've got two sides to the Republican Party. You have the Christian base, which needs to be mobilized to win elections. And you have another part of the party, a big part of the party, the moneyed part of the party, which is the East Coast establishment with certain political affiliations that distinguish it from the Democratic Party. But it's Wall Street. It's not Main Street. And there's always this conflict in the party between those two components of the GOP.
It's going to be interesting to hear if the subject of Georgia and Russia comes up during Sarah Palin's debate with Senator Joe Biden, who obviously has a lot more experience than she does in foreign policy. But as I understand it, she is being now coached by John McCain's senior staffer, who has in fact worked for Georgia as a lobbyist.
I mean, to the extent that Sarah Palin is going to be talking about foreign policy in regard to the U.S. relationship with Georgia and Russia, then she'll have no doubt been coached either directly or indirectly by Randy Scheinman, who has lobbied for the government of Georgia and has really helped that government in Washington. And so surely her point of view is going to be filtered through the Scheinman point of view. I mean, in the case of Georgia, it is true. You've got a lobbyist for the government who's extremely close to McCain. McCain's views on the crisis, you know, very much echoed the Georgian government's point of view. And I think that's a problem, or at least, you know, this is an issue that people need to be aware of. I mean, you've got a guy who's gotten paid a very good chunk of change by the government of Georgia, who's McCain's senior advisor. So it's not just, you know, whether he's prepping Sarah Palin, but if McCain were elected, clearly the government of Georgia would have a very comfortable relationship, I'm quite sure, with the McCain administration.
You know, the question there, too, is, you know, Palin has been basically running now on the platform that what she knows about foreign policy, she knows because you can see Russia from her house.
Mm-hmm.
Not a very sophisticated analysis, but if she is prepped by someone like Schuneman, who's been at this for decades, it's one has to wonder how much of what he tells her she's really going to understand, you know, versus what she tries to argue. And it could be a very difficult argument for her to win, you know?
Well, I think that's going to be true with a lot of issues with Palin, because clearly she's been the governor of Alaska for a short period of time, and before that the mayor. So, there's a big learning curve on a lot of issues, and certainly on foreign policy. She doesn't appear to have much experience, so I would think that she's pretty much going to be repeating whatever talking points the McCain campaign gives her on foreign policy and, you know, most everything else. In part, this is because the McCain, like any campaign, they're going to want us to, quote, stay on message. And I'm sure Biden also is going to have his talking points that he's going to stick to, but certainly Palin does not have a lot of experience with foreign policy, and that's a real weakness. And obviously she's in lockdown being prepped for the vice presidential debate and just for the campaign trail in general. And, you know, clearly we've already seen in some of her interviews that her expertise is not deep.
Ken Silverstein, do you think that we're seeing a new era here where things are so bad on Wall Street and in general within Congress that basically the era of wag the dog is starting to maybe draw to a close? I mean, the American people are seeing through a lot more today than they did yesterday.
That's difficult to predict. I think our political system offers us very narrow options, in part because of the money issue that I talked about earlier. I mean, we just have a political system that's very narrowly based on a real small number of donors, and that just means that the American people don't have a lot of options, because if you want to raise money, you're not going to anger your donors. I mean, you're certainly not going to do it routinely or regularly. So, you know, I think people have actually been upset and angry with the political options for a long time. Unfortunately, there's not much of an outlet. We have seen that both of the parties offer, you know, there's not a huge difference between them. I mean, on some of the social issues, but people don't really have adequate choices, or what happens from here remains to be seen. I mean, certainly it's going to be an interesting election, and if Obama were to win, I certainly will be curious to see if he actually takes on these entrenched interests that have dominated the political system for so long. It will be very interesting to see. But, of course, that remains for November, and we'll see who the winner of the election is. I think both of the candidates are fairly restricted in their options by a variety of factors, including the influence of money and special interest groups. The opportunity or possibility of any sort of notable change is certainly more restricted under McCain.
You have another book out. It's published by Random House, and it has an interesting title, A Play on the Name of the Country, Turkmenistan. The title of the book is Turkmeniscam, How Washington Lobbyists Fought to Flak for a Stalinist Dictatorship. How did you come to write about this topic?
The book grew out of a Harper's Magazine article that ran last summer, and for the article, I posed as their representative of a London-based company that supposedly had a big stake in the Turkmen natural gas fields, which is a huge multi-billion-dollar industry that's very corrupt. And I approached a number of the top Washington lobbying firms and asked them if they would be interested in representing the government on behalf of my company, my phony company, and improve its image in the United States, both with policymakers and the public. And so the story in the magazine and now the book in expanded form tells the story of my interactions with the lobbyists and how they not only offered to work on my behalf for the government of Turkmenistan, but sort of lays out what their game plan was in terms of trying to win influence with members of Congress and trying to shape media coverage of Turkmenistan. So in putting together the magazine piece way back in the fall of 2006, I was motivated by the fact that despite all the uproar about Abramoff and Duke Cunningham, the former member of Congress who's now in prison for taking bribes, that, you know, despite the uproar about the corrupt relationship between lobbyists and members of Congress, not a whole lot had actually been done to change the situation. And now, 2 years later, after the idea for the magazine piece first arose, you know, we still have a situation where the role of lobbyists, has, despite the passage of a reform bill, is pretty much, if not entirely unchecked, largely unchecked. I mean, we saw this during the last political conventions of both the Democratic and Republican parties, where you had, despite rules that were supposed to prevent lobbyists from hosting parties, you essentially had hundreds of parties specialized by private interest groups. You had a lot of parties hosted at the conventions by lobbying firms. And, you know, this was just supposed to be flat out banned by the reform bill that Congress passed. And once again, we see that these bills are filled with loopholes. And that's not surprising because, as I said up top, lobbyists are an essential component in our political system. When you're raising large sums of money, they're very important. You know, so there's a financial relationship. Often these lobbyists, as we know, are former members of Congress or former Hill staffers or former executive branch officials. So, you know, they have access in that way too. And even though my book really looks primarily at the world of foreign lobbying, there's a whole lot of overlap with just the general, you know, the theme of the general unchecked influence of lobbyists in Washington. And there, you know, even some of the characters like Charlie Black, I discuss in my book because he used to work for a firm that represented really some of the world's worst dictatorships. And it's clear during this campaign, we've got both McCain and Obama denouncing lobbyists. I think it's an important issue. It's like the fourth branch of government. And I think the more that the spotlight is shined on these people, the better, because it's hard to keep track of what they're up to, but they play a very, very important role.
Now, at what point did you tell the would-be lobbyists for Turkmenistan what was going on, or did you?
I did not tell them what was going on. They found out when the piece hit the newsstands, when they were contacted by the Washington Post. I made a decision, which some people criticized me for in the media, because the piece did generate a bit of controversy. I made a decision not to contact them before the piece came out, because it would have meant contacting them 6 weeks ahead of our July 2007 issue's arrival on newsstands, and I just felt that that would give them an inordinate amount of time to shape and distort the story and to turn it into a story about the undercover reporting angle as opposed to the lobbying angle. And I did not contact them until the piece came out, and needless to say, when it did come out, they weren't terribly happy, which can't hold against them.
But you did manage to convey to them, too, the impression that the leaders in Turkmenistan that you wanted them to lobby for in Washington were dictators. Is it the case that they don't really care about the level of dictatorship? How would you characterize the people that you dealt with on that level?
They saw it as a business opportunity. I met with two lobbying firms, APCO and Cassidy and Associates, and the former was going to do the job for $40,000 a month, and the latter, Cassidy, wanted to charge $5 million over 3 years, roughly $5 million, $1.5 million a year. They saw it as a business opportunity, and they were going to promote Turkmenistan as, you know, an important energy supplier and energy ally of the United States and possibly as an ally in the war on terrorism and, you know, use these various hooks, which got as far away from the question of human rights and civil liberties as possible, since the government of Turkmenistan has such a horrible record in that regard, and try to market it and sell it to the public and policymakers on the basis of anything but human rights. So our foreign policy is not set by lobbyists. There are a variety of issues that have greater weight, you know, and certainly, you know, when you look at Saudi Arabia, for example, Saudi Arabia has always used lobbyists, but Saudi Arabia, the relationship there has always been based on oil. I mean, Saudi Arabia doesn't need a lot of lobbying help because they have oil, and that's, you know, in many cases, an asset like that can go a long way in winning the friendship of the U.S. government, whether it's Republican or a Democratic administration. In the case of a smaller country like Turkmenistan, which has not got a vital role to play in U.S. foreign policy, you know, then you see where lobbyists, again, they're not going to set American foreign policy. They're not going to make American foreign policy, but they can influence it. And that's what these foreign dictatorships want. I mean, there's a limit. I don't want to oversell the influence and power of lobbyists. It's important, but it's also, you know, it wouldn't be accurate to suggest that the whole sort of foreign policy agenda is in any way set by lobbyists. They can work with good raw material. So if you've got a client that's energy-rich, lobbyists can do a lot of good. In fact, you know, I think if you look at the U.S. relationship with two African countries, Equatorial Guinea, a small country which has, you know, become a very big exporter of oil and where American oil companies have, I don't know, at last count, $5 billion of investment, versus Zimbabwe, which does not have oil and which is a pariah state in the eyes of the United States government. And I will say, I mean, deservedly so, you know, the Mugabe government is not an attractive government. But what's interesting about it is that Equatorial Guinea, its government is worse, I think, by almost any objective measure than the government of Zimbabwe. It's a more repressive government. There is absolutely no room for political maneuver or political opposition. And yet, no one says a peep about Equatorial Guinea in Congress or certainly at by the Bush administration, because it's an important energy ally. And Zimbabwe, which really doesn't have anything that we desperately want, is severely criticized and ostracized. And again, I mean, this is not a defense of the government there, but, you know, if you've got oil or some other important asset that we want, like in the case of China, you know, a huge consumer market, then that goes a long way toward winning your foreign policy agenda in Washington. A government like Turkmenistan and some other controversial countries with assets like that rely more on the help of Washington lobbyists.
Ken Silverstein, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Ken Silverstein is Washington editor for Harper's Magazine. He writes Washington Babylon for Harper's Online. He also wrote in the October 1st edition of Harper's that, quote, election officials across the country are routinely striking millions of voters from the rolls through a process that is shrouded in secrecy, prone to error, and vulnerable to manipulation. Between 2004 and 2006, 39 states and the District of Columbia reported purging more than 13 million voters from registration rolls. You can read more at harpers.org. Ken Silverstein has also written extensively about the lobby industry, the CIA, as well as international politics and oil. In addition to Turkmenistan, Ken Silverstein is author of The Radioactive Boy Scout. As the vice presidential debate approached, major news networks spent most of the day talking about whether or not Democrat Joe Biden could afford to look like a bully as he took on the less experienced Republican, Governor Sarah Palin. Major issues fell by the wayside, and news began to resemble a famous Hollywood picture.
It seems that Senator Neal has discovered something.
Well, it makes no difference about Senator Neal. I don't care what Senator Neal's got. We got a war.
Look at that girl. Doesn't she look Albanian? Looks like she was born and raised in Albania.
Mm-hmm.
Got an instinct for casting. Don't ask me why.
That's good.
That's beautiful.
Of course, we'll need some water.
Oh, is it a stream?
No, I think...
A pond?
No, I think it's a calico kitten.
She's running across with a kitten. Can we have a calico kitten, please?
There it is. We have a small calico kitten, sir.
What?
The president wants a white one.
He wants a white one? A white... Let me talk to him.
He's mobilizing the 6th Fleet.
Connie, can I please talk to him?
He's mobilizing the 6th Fleet.
Why do I hate it when they start to meddle?
And that, of course, part of the trailer for Dustin Hoffman's film, Wag the Dog. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced at the studios of WHUS at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live, Wednesdays at 5 p.m. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions.